Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a very great pleasure for me to introduce our speaker this evening. Professor Frederick Steward is a very distinguished botanist with a very wide range of interests in plant biology. He doesn't like introductions, I've been told, but I've explained to him that the audience here will naturally be very curious about him. And so we have to look at him, not as a specimen, sir, but as I said, as a distinguished visitor. Professor Steward got first class honors in chemistry at Leeds University at the age of 20. He got a PhD at the age of 23. He was married in 1929 at the age of 25, and he's never looked back. He went to the United States after getting his PhD and spent 2 years, I think, as a Rockefeller Foundation at Cornell and at Berkeley. He went back to Britain and held an academic post at Leeds, moved on to a higher academic post in botany at Birkbeck College. By that time, the war was on, and he served as a director of aircraft equipment for the Ministry of Aircraft Production from 1940 to 1945. After that, he moved back to the United States and was head of the Department of Botany at Rochester University. Then he moved to Cornell as professor of botany, where he spent a period from 1950 to 1960, and is now retired, but for the last 10 years, I think he was director of the Laboratory of Cell Physiology and Growth, which was an autonomous institution at Cornell University. He's been Charles A. Alexander Professor of Biological Sciences at Cornell from 1970 to 73. He's a scholar in residence at the State University of New York. During all this time, he has gathered to himself well-earned honors. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of London, which I think is probably the most distinguished academic body in the world, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's won the Stephen Hales Award, the Stephen Hales Prize in plant physiology. Stephen Hales was a very famous English plant physiologist in the Middle Ages, and he has been C.V. Raman visiting professor at Madras in India. Well, I can tell you a little more about Professor Steward than that. I first met him when he visited McGill during the academic year 1945 to 46, when I was an undergraduate. And I remember that the students who heard him at that time were most impressed by his abilities as a lecturer and by his very evident energy and drive. Well, I've had the privilege of hearing him at a number of scientific meetings in the intervening years, and I've never noticed any lessening of his enthusiasm, clarity, or in his ability to hold an audience. And so I really feel that we're in for a very great pleasure this evening. There's one point further that I would like to add. I remember that at a symposium on nitrogen fixation in Reading University in England in 1958 or 59, Professor Steward was, I think, virtually alone in challenging some views that had been put forward by an American scientist who shall be nameless. And the views that were being put forward dealt with the problem of protein synthesis in an artificial system. Now, this is a very important topic, and it was being claimed that this synthesis in vitro had been accomplished, and Professor Steward was, as I say, alone in challenging this view. There was quite a row at the meeting, and the reason that I mention it is because subsequent events have completely vindicated Professor Steward's view. He's a man who knows his own mind. He's a very critical fellow, and I'm very pleased to introduce him to you tonight. He's going to speak to you on cloning, and you will see that his work has both a basic interest and it has a lot of implications for applied fields in agriculture and forestry. Professor Steward.
I don't usually do this, but I've got one of your local infections, so my voice isn't what it ought to be. Yeah, thank you. Good. Madam Chairman, members of the Institute, and Professor Shaw, thank you very much for this kind reception. I'm very glad to be here. I only wish, as I say, my voice is going to hold out. I only wish it was what it normally is. The kind of introduction I don't like, incidentally, for Professor Shaw, is the one which I call the cradle to the grave type. And since it's a long way from the former and getting nearer the latter, I really don't want to be reminded about it too much. Now, the topic I'm going to talk about needs just a little bit of byplay with a piece of chalk and a blackboard before I begin. No professor is really comfortable wholly without chalk. And so, if this will reach, here we are. I'm going to talk about the growth and development and reproduction of sexually reproduced organisms. Higher plants are sexually reproduced. Some of them don't always avail themselves of it. But higher plants are sexually reproduced organisms, and so are higher animals, ourselves included. And as you know, the sexual reproduction involves cells of a particular kind, which are called gametes. And these have a single batch of chromosomes, a paternal batch in the male sex cells and a maternal batch in the female sex cells. I don't think I need explain what these symbols mean, because at least in the United States, we had a program called Ben Casey, which told the entire United States what those symbols mean. But at any rate, what happens is that individually, these cells rarely grow. Sometimes in plants, by special tricks, they can be made to, but they rarely grow. But when they fuse, the information, the genetic information, gets into one cell. And that one cell is a fertilized egg, and botanists at least have a special name for it. They call it the zygote. But everything begins with that one cell. It has the entire potentiality for making the whole organism. Its structure, its biochemistry, its working, its machinery, everything is there. And the first thing that has to happen is that that cell has to divide. And as it divides, it makes two identical parts, facsimiles of the original. And this goes on, and you get multiplication by this process of division. One of the first essential things that happens is in the particular environment of the sex cell, of the egg, the stimulation of that cell division. And I spoke a good deal about that on a lecture I gave in this room a couple of days ago. So I'm not going to repeat that story. But the part I want to talk about can be simply summarized like this. When the egg is fertilized, all the information gets into the egg, but it possesses what I like to call a built-in capacity to grow. A built-in capacity to grow, which is not shared by the gametes, the sex cells themselves. And in the special environment in which it is, this capacity to grow is expressed. And that takes, as it were, a long journey through time and space. And that's the journey which we call growth and development. But the point is that in higher plants, we can now intervene at various points along this route. And we can, as it were, capture or isolate or segregate body cells. Cells which are no longer like this, but have become part of the permanent structure of the plant. And by appropriate chemical tricks, we can bring them back, not only into the state of active growth and division again, but we can make them behave like fertilized eggs. We can make them, in short, make embryos. But when they do that, you see, we've bypassed this normal process of sexual reproduction by which the egg arises. In other words, we're getting out cells which, because their nuclei have come directly from these, are exact genetical facsimiles of this egg, and this produces a population of identical individuals. And that is what botanists call a clone. A population of identical individuals with the same genetic identity. Now we'll see also that in plants, this journey which the egg takes is much more plastic, it's much more controllable, it's much more subject to change than is that of a higher animal. And in this and in many other ways, the development of a higher animal and a higher plant differ. And so because we can do this kind of thing in plants, it has been speculated that one day we'll be able to do it with animals and even with humans. And that really is the subject of my talk, which is facts and fancies about cloning plants and people. Well, now essentially you've got the message. We'll put the lights low and those of you who feel drowsy can go to sleep. And I'll use slides to tell my story. I've had to call on the assistants, the able assistants which you see in front of me, because I'm quite incapable of punching all the buttons and making them do the right thing at the right time. Now, when I was once called upon to give a lecture somewhat like this, some years ago, I was wondering how I'd begin. And it was summertime, and in my garden, I saw the New York Times and the magazine section had a slide in it. And the slide on it, the slide which you'll see, had a picture of this. Shouldn't we be using that?
No, we can't use that one.
Well, are they going to show up on a ball? I will see on a black screen. I don't think the color will show, will it?
The color of what?
Will it? Okay. I always learn things anyway. Well, anyway, here's the diagram which you'll see in the New York slide, in the New York Times. You can tell the date of it because of these projectiles here, which are the Saturn series, not the later known Apollo ones. And the whole theme of this was the massive engineering which is needed to make one of these projectiles go off into space. And here you see the Statue of Liberty, which is 300 feet high, was likened to the Saturn, which is this one. And so I thought, well, here's a good opening gambit. Because I was likening the journey of the egg through its in its growth and development to a journey through time and space. And here's one of the great man-made journeys through time and space in a way that you're all now familiar with. But think how different it is. This thing has not only tremendous size, but it wastes a tremendous amount of energy. It goes off with a tremendous whoosh, and there's a tremendous amount of heat and noise. Blast off, we call it, and off it goes. And in the early days, it sometimes went to the right place and sometimes it didn't. But it had a guidance system up here, and still has. In that incredibly small nose cone up there where the astronauts sit is the guidance system. But that's only half of it, a part of it. Because if you go to Houston for the Space Center, you see this enormous room with television cameras and people using computers to keep this thing on its track and record it. And even that is not all, because scattered all around the world are these tracking stations. So here we have a journey which is propelled, it has a guidance system, a source of motive power and direction, and a plan of its course. But think how different is that of an egg in development. And if we can revert a little to the human side of it, let me use this other little piece of diagram, which wasn't in the New York Times. Because I was reminded of the days when I used to teach elementary biology to men students first and women students second. They were all separate in those days at the University of Rochester. And I gave all the elementary botany lectures except those that introduced the genetics. Because we then had Professor Kurt Stern, who wrote many books that some of you may know about, and so he always came down to introduce the cell cytology and the genetics. And I've always remembered how he emphasized how compact was the information that controlled development. And he said, let's assume that we can get from every female on the face of the earth, then it was a number which is now exceeded, but you see there, 4 × 10⁹ is a fantastically big number. He said, let's assume we have one egg from each viable female. In what volume would it go? And he said, they'll all go in a 5-quart pickle jar. So there's a 5-quart pickle jar with all the female eggs necessary to regenerate the entire population of the then world. But it only takes one sperm to fertilize one egg. It's true that nature makes sure by making a vast overproduction. But in what volume would one sperm to fertilize from all the males go in what volume to fertilize all the eggs? And he said then, and I'm taking his word for it, that they'd all go in the size of an aspirin tablet. And there they are. But we now know what we didn't know then, that the story is even more remarkable than that. Because the material substance which carries that information of the sperm and the egg is that substance which, as by its initial, has almost become a household word, DNA, the genetic material. And if the arithmetic is right, as Bruce Wallace at Cornell assured me it was, then all the information which is necessary in that enormous numbers of eggs fertilized by that enormous number of sperms would be 26 milligrams, or 1/15 the weight of an aspirin tablet. In other words, chemically, if we had all that stuff and understand it in a bottle, in a substance, it represents the information that represents the prehistory of the human population and its entire potentiality for the future. Well, that's only another way of pointing out that in terms of chemical engineering, we're dealing here with something that makes the great triumphs of our modern engineering system pale into insignificance. So at least we can have respect for the smallness within which this efficiency is carried out. And now this is the spiral structure of this stuff, and I don't need to bother with that because most of you have read Scientific American and everybody accepts this new religion, which is the modern gospel of molecular biology. But now let's come again a little bit, can that focus? Let's come a little bit to the scale on which these things happen in higher plants. How do we focus?
Be done for us in just a moment.
Oh, I see. Let's get the scale on which this thing happens in higher plants. Let's assume that the fertilized egg in the ovule that I'm going to show you about has made a little embryo. It quickly develops, as it were, a head and a tail, except in plants we call it a shoot and a root. And this entire structure that produces the entire form of the shoot is very small. And here I've likened it not to the Statue of Liberty, that's better, but to the size of my ballpoint pen. This little bit up here, the whole thing would go in the very tip of the ballpoint pen. And all the information to make a chickweed or an oak tree is carried out by the growth of this tip and under the chemical stimuli that it receives. But at the other end of the axis is a root tip, which is entirely different. And that, again, as you can see, is very small. But as we shall see later, this, which has already happened at a very early stage, happens without destroying the innate potentiality of the cells of the shoot and the root. Because we're going to see that if we take cells from here or from there and isolate them, by appropriate stimuli, we can make them behave like eggs again because they have all the information to do so. In other words, the properties which reveal the shoot and the root are inherent, not in the innate characteristics of cells, but in the organization of which they form a part. And here is a series of photographs from a particular favorite plant of mine, namely a mint plant. And here you see the little tiny shoot tip up there. These are little leaf initials, young leaves. These are buds. And this is the axis, the stem. And here see the beautiful pattern which this thing forms if you cut a slice through there. But here's a root tip. Entirely different form and appearance. But if you take cells from here or from here, not necessarily from the mint, but from other plants, then the whole plant can be reconstituted from them. Now, I mentioned earlier that in plants, the course of development isn't absolutely fixed and definite. In animals, it is, or at least much more so. Animals form their organs very, very early, and they're very defined. You have two arms, two legs, two eyes, one brain, spinal cord, all the rest of it. But higher plants can make their organs repetitively. A perennial plant makes lots of leaves, lots of stems, and it keeps on doing it. And as we shall see, this makes it easier to do some of the things I'm going to describe with plants than with animals. But the other thing is, a human grows more or less the same, nutritional factors apart. At least his gross morphology is the same, whether you grow him up in the Arctic or near the tropics. He's recognizably similar in gross morphology. It's very different with plants because they respond to lengths of day and night temperatures. This whole system can be modulated. The course of that journey can be modified. And here you see mint plants grown under long days in water culture, whereas the next one shows the same cuttings from the same clone grown under short days, and they're very different. You might be excused for not thinking that was a mint plant at all. It has runners and short leaves, no flowers, and even it's more than that, because if you examine the biochemistry of those two plants, they're really quite different. But now let's come back again to the environment in which this egg first starts off this remarkable journey. I have a slide which I'm not showing, which I used to use sometimes on these occasions, because I once remember opening, when I was in Rochester, the pages of Life magazine, and there was an article called The Sex Life of the Gladiolus. And I thought, well, that ought to interest the men on the men's campus, and think there's some point in doing botany. But I read it and it was entirely wrong, because all the floral parts were called sex organs. Now, the sex life of flowering plants is a little more complicated than you many perhaps think. And it's easier to, the homologies are not as easy to understand. But I'm not going to talk about the gladiolus, but here you see it in terms of the cherry. Because here the egg in the cherry, this big cell here, is in a sort of a nursing organ. And that nursing organ, botanists call an ovule. There are actually often about 8 nuclei in this structure, which is called an embryo sac, and potentially each one of them could become an egg, but the one that functions so is by virtue of its position. And the male side of the reproductive cycle is reduced to those 2 little nuclei right there. One of those fuses with the egg, and we'll say what happens to the other in a moment. But this journey in the case of the cherry begins when those 2 gametes fuse, and the fused fertilized egg has this built-in capacity to grow. But in order for it to express that capacity to grow, it needs the special stimuli which are laid down precociously in this structure here, this thing called an embryo sac. And this little other nucleus here fuses with this one, which also has a capacity to grow. In fact, it usually outgrows the egg itself, and it pulls in nutrient and stuff and stimuli from the parent plant body to get this one off its ground, off the ground. In other words, the initial thrust that I talked about comes from the special nutrients and stimuli in the liquid bathing medium in the embryo sac in which the fertilized egg is contained. And last time I pointed out how the cell divisions, which have to go on apace as that egg forms a little embryo, are stimulated by that liquid stuff. But the liquid stuff that we have to do this isn't usually got out of an embryo sac as small as this, but we go to a special dispensation of providence, namely a coconut. For a coconut is a very large fruit with a dormant embryo. The embryo, once it's fertilized, develops a little bit, then it stops. But nature lays down precociously inside the center of the coconut all the special stuff which will be needed when that embryo begins to grow. And for entirely other reasons that I'm not going to discuss tonight, way back in Rochester, just after the war, we were looking around for 2 systems, one composed of quiescent cells that were just barely ticking over, like a motor engine with a clutch out, just idling, just staying alive, but not doing anything very much. And the same kind of system with the clutch in gear, where it was going places as fast as it could. And we found this system in carrot tissue, because there's a little plug of carrot taken out of an ordinary carrot root on a medium which has in it almost everything that the carrot cells ought to require to grow. Salts and sugars and vitamins, sterile conditions and a suitable temperature. But if you put that, and nothing much happens, it sluggishly expands, but very little cell division. But if you put that same piece of carrot tissue on the same medium, supplementing it with a little coconut milk, the fluid out of the central cavity of a coconut, this goes to that. And that was a very exciting moment when we realized actually what had happened. Now here is what botanists call the morphology of the coconut, and I won't dwell on it. A coconut is an enormous fruit with one locule here. There are 3 partitions, but they're broken down, and underneath that soft eye there, the one soft eye, is the dormant embryo like that. And it sits there doing nothing whilst this enormous fruit develops and until it falls on the ground. And when it's ready to germinate, it sends out this bladder-like structure here into the central cavity, and that absorbs the special nutriment material, which is the liquid endosperm of the coconut, that makes the embryo grow. So the point of this is that liquid stuff, that coconut milk or coconut water, the liquid endosperm of the coconut, is the special nutritive nourishing fluid that nourishes an immature embryo. And that stuff is capable of taking carrot cells, adult carrot cells, and making them grow fast again, like a fertilized egg has to do. And this diagram shows how we turned that observation into a technique. That isn't focused for me, but I hope it's sufficiently focused for you. Here's the carrot, and we have a slicer up top there, like this. And we do this under sterile conditions. We take out little plugs of carrot tissue, so far removed from the cambium, the growing tissue of the carrot, so they wouldn't grow again. And we dispense those into these funny-looking tubes like this. We put them on a wheel and let them revolve around slowly, one revolution a minute. And then 2 milligrams of carrot here becomes 2 or 3 milligrams of carrot here becomes 200 to 250 milligrams in about 20 days. In other words, it grows about 80 times in weight in 20 days. But if you break down, if you macerate those little pieces of tissue and count cells, it actually makes more cells than it makes fresh weight. So by any standards, this is a tremendous increase in growth by cell division and by increase in fresh weight. And a very old version of this apparatus, which will suffice for the purpose, we have these revolving wheels, and each one of them takes about 24 tubes, like this one here. And when the little piece of carrot is, when the tube is upright, it sticks to the glass and the liquid drains down and so on. And it's all done under aseptic conditions. This funny these funny-looking flasks here, I'll tell you about later, because they were the origin of our free cell culture studies. But now, this shows you some of the dangers of talking to the press. Because on one occasion in Rochester, I sat next to the then scientific correspondent of the New York Times. He wrote an article on the next Sunday about carrots and coconuts. It got all over the world. It went into Ripley's Believe It or Not. My mail was flooded with people who wanted to know whether there was any money in coconut milk and all sorts of things. But finally, after this had been going some time, a cartoonist in the Evening Bulletin, Philadelphia, May 9, 1949, protected for all time my priority to the discovery of what happens to carrots if you give them some coconut milk. But now let's take a big jump. And this slide obviously has a history which I'll tell you about. On another occasion, I had to give a lecture in somewhere in the Middle West, St. Louis, I think, to a bunch of scientific newspaper correspondents. They were having a workshop, a seminar, and I gave the evening lecture at the end of it. And one of them was the scientific correspondent of one of our better-known weeklies that has a lot of colored pictures, and I won't tell you which one it was. And so they came to the laboratory and took pictures of how we did all this, and there they are. There's the slices and the cannula and a little piece of tissue. And we'd learned in the meanwhile how to do something else other than merely let those pieces of plucked carrot tissue grow in an unorganized way. Because we'd learned how to disentangle them, as it were, into free cells and inoculate free cells into these funny-looking flasks. And we grew large numbers, not of unorganized pieces of tissue, but embryos. And here's a filamentous embryo just beginning, and there are the embryos of carrot forming nicely as they would in an ovule. Then you take this out and you put it in the tube and make carrot plants as many as you want. And hundreds of thousands could be got out of a very small volume like that in the carrot flask there. Well, they were going to publish these pictures, and I thought, well, they'll need my text to say what it meant. And what they did, as often happens in the press, they used the pictures but did not use my text. And what they did say was a whole lot of things that I didn't approve of. Amongst other things, they said, well, if you can do this with carrots, why can't you do it with people? You ought to be able to get a few cells out of your little finger and make a whole lot of new yous. And that I didn't approve of at all, and said so. But later on, the State Department wrote to me and said they had a journal which was published behind the Iron Curtain to tell them what was going on in the United States behind the Iron scientifically. And could they use the pictures, which are these? And so I said, yes, you can use the pictures, provided the first publisher agrees, but this time use my text. So they got the pictures, and there they are. And I don't know whether this is Russian or Estonian or whatnot. In fact, I don't really know whether they used my text because I haven't had it translated, and it would spoil the story if I did. So now that's the beginning about the cloning, first of carrots, and the idea, if you can do it with carrots, why can't you do it with animals or with people? And then things started to happen fast. In England, the Sunday Observer had this picture, and because my name got mentioned in the article, my friends in England were sending them over to me. In fact, there was a book published, some of you may have read it, by a man named Gordon Rattray Taylor called The Biological Time Bomb. And my name was taken in vain in so many chapters that my less well-disposed acquaintances suggested that he was one of my graduate students and I'd put him up to it. But that was far from the truth. I'd never even met the chap. But at any rate, what he said was, if you need astronauts with very special properties, why wait for nature to produce them haphazard? You pick out one with all the desired attributes, and then you clone him. And you get identical copies, all with the same properties. And he said, if you can do it with carrots one day, you'll do it with humans. Now, there's a journal which professors are really not supposed to see. I usually see it in the dentist chair or when I'm flying in aeroplanes, called Playboy Magazine. And Playboy Magazine had a very different version of this, which I haven't got a picture of. Because Playboy said, well, if you have one sex symbol occasionally, and you know who they've been at successive times, I won't mention the name, why wait for them to turn up casually? Get a good one and then clone her. And you have as many as you want for all time. Well, one Gina Lola Brigida would be interesting, but 500,000 identical copies, I don't think would be very good. But at any rate, this is part of what we're going to talk about. This is part of the fancy, and I hope in a minute to tell you part of the fact and tell you where I think the subject lies. But to revert to Gordon Rattray Taylor, this is an actual photograph of a bit of the text in his book. The first work was done over 5 years ago. It's many more years than that now, of course. Professor F.C. Stewart, a chemist. That's the part I really like, but everybody had forgotten that I was originally a chemist. And in any way, he produced carrots by nurturing carrot cells. The implication is that one could eventually produce animals, even human beings, from a few cells, scraped from the skin surface and so on. And then at the bottom, he said, a glimpse of the possibilities is given by the work of Dr. J.B. Gurdon of Oxford University. He's now at Cambridge, but I'll tell you about that later. So that's the fancy. Now let's come and look at some of the facts and some of the difficulties. This particular kind of flask was devised for an entirely different purpose. It was devised... I hope I'm not quite as unstable as that. Fine, just leave it there. Well, anyway, we can manage, I think, to overcome that slight aberration. Anyway, the flask here contains a lot of pieces of carrot tissue without the coconut milk. And you see they stay about the way they were when we put them in, and they sit there in the liquid. This liquid, however, if you add coconut milk to it...
Excuse me, we're going to switch to the center screen in just a minute.
Okay. Well, if you can wear it, I can. We're now going to see in the next one what happens if you add the coconut milk to that flask and make it into a sort of glass artificial ovule or carrot embryo sac. And you'll see that when you put in the coconut milk into that thing, that every one of the little carrot explants grows, as you saw, about 80 times in 20 days, and they form nice green round balls. And these balls of tissue were really intended for something else. They were intended to study the biochemistry, and in order to give us enough material easily. But nature gave us a special reward. I say it gave me a reward for not grinding her up in a homogenate all the time, like chemists usually do. I preserved the organization. And in the as the flask generally rolled around, the little green balls of tissue rubbed against each other, and some of the outside cells were gently rubbed off into the liquid. And then we had cells that can grow in a medium that makes them grow free in a big space in which they can grow. And then we find that suppose we've got to wait till it comes on. And then we found actually that these free cells grow in an entirely different way. When I first saw those things, I thought, well, perhaps the technicians have got them infected. And much to my delight and amazement, I saw the most beautiful living cells of carrot cells that I'd ever seen. But the cells that were free from their contact with the normal tissue of their origin, behaved entirely different. It looked, as it were, as though the cells rubbed off from these, feeling themselves, as it were, in that special medium enriched with coconut milk, were able to imitate eggs. And they not only grew apace very rapidly, but I'll show you, they remembered how to be embryos and eventually grew like eggs into embryos and implantlets in very large numbers. Here's a free cell with its nucleus, lots of streaming protoplasm. A cell obviously going places, an active machine. And then on an occasion we kept those things just as curios for a while. And for a set of circumstances that I've forgotten now, we inoculated them back into the same medium in a tube in which, like those in which we grew the explants in the beginning. And that population of cells filled up the whole tube with roots without any special devices on our part. It just remembered how to be roots and made roots. So we said, well, if they know how to make roots, we ought to be able to make them form shoots. It took a little doing, and I won't go into all the details because it's published now some years ago. But here you see a picture which was published in Science. There's the free cell. There's an early stage in its growth and proliferation. You see it's grown this way and it's beginning to grow that way. But it's already got a certain measure of organization. It's got a different form up here than it has there. The beginnings of an axis. And when this thing proliferates, you'll see it forms a root tip and a shoot tip. And I'll never forget the first time when we spread those things out on an agar surface and my then assistant, Mrs. Mapes, and I pulled out literally hundreds of these little embryos, very much like ordinary carrot embryos grown from seed, except these had come from body cells, and they were almost exactly like ordinary carrot embryos, except they were a little bigger. And we'd plant those out on agar and get little plantlets and put them in pots and grow them in the greenhouse and get real carrot roots. You could eat them if they weren't too expensive at that stage. And then after the normal biennial cycle, it forms an inflorescence and sets seed. So we've bypassed the whole sexual reproduction of the carrot by these devices. And without using cuttings, you see, if you take a cutting or a bud, you have the organization of the bud or the cutting already there. We've broken it down. We've unscrambled Humpty Dumpty down to the cellular level, put it back together again. We've used the environment, the chemical environment of the ovule. And here it's done a little bit better from a cell system taken out of the Queen Anne's lace, a weed of our gardens. In fact, actually, this came from a weed, a plant out of our garden in Ithaca. And then we simply took young embryos, young plantlets out of immature seeds. At a younger stage, we grew them as cells. We spread the cells over the surface of an agar surface and estimated that on one agar dish, about 4 or 5 inches in diameter, there were several hundred thousand of these organized structures. And hunting around, we got all the normal development, globular, heart-shaped, torpedo-shaped, cotyledonary embryos, and little plants into pots, and eventually forming the inflorescence of the Queen Anne's lace that you see there. So the whole life cycle has been created anew from body cells. And we do it now even better than that because we make the thing more or less continuous. Here are the flasks in which the cells originate. That's the kind of cell. And we put them back into flasks like this and go through these stages. But here you see a drop out of that liquid. That isn't disorganized material. It represents the growth of free cells that rub off from those little seedling plants as they topple around, and being in the right kind of medium, they go through the cycle all over again. So you can filter this off and start again and keep a colony like that going until all the nutrients and all the stimuli are used up. And out of a very small inoculum in a flask like this that you couldn't even see, and you certainly couldn't weigh, you can produce hundreds of thousands of perfectly viable carrot plants. In fact, here you see the sort of thing. I think actually this is the water parsnip, a close relative of the carrot, but it doesn't really matter. There's the flask with full of plantlets, some of it tipped out here into a petri dish. The diameter there is about 4.5 inches, so you can get a measure of scale. Here it is in a 250 ml beaker, the entire crop, and there are the little plantlets shown individually. And so what nicer plantlets could you require than this? These are the water parsnip plants, which grows as well or even better than the carrot, complete with shoots and roots down to every detail. But now, naturally, we try to do it with a lot of other things. And there's no trick to getting many plants into the free cell stage like this. And then a very interesting thing comes out, that just as eggs in embryo sacs look pretty much alike wherever they come from, the free cells from many different plants look very much alike. And I've forgotten which ones these are now, and it doesn't matter. One is Pelionia, one is carrot, one is tobacco, and so on. But you see, they look very much alike. In fact, if you mix the cells at that stage, you'd never be able to sort them out by eye unless you grew them into their respective plants. And here they all look, all growing on the same medium, and this was coconut milk enriched with naphthalene acetic acid and the basal medium, and they're all doing their stuff except this one. That one obviously isn't really trying. And that's asparagus. There was a special genetic reason for us trying to grow asparagus. And this culture had been on the same medium as this one, and there it was. And we kept that culture just ticking over for many, many months by sub-transfer to new lots of medium. And then a technician made a mistake. And often fortunate mistakes trigger off the unexpected. Because the technician transferred that culture that had been on the basal medium plus coconut milk and naphthalene acetic acid, transferred it to a medium containing 2,4-D. And then it took off like wildfire. And you see how organized this is. It's obviously got a head and a tail already. It's trying to be an embryo. And so we realized that something happened during the culture on naphthalene acetic acid that enabled it to respond to 2,4-D, the weed killer, in ways that it previously wouldn't do. And we call this the sequential effect, because in order to imitate the signals that happen in the normal course of development of the egg, as I showed you over there, you have to give the signals in the right order. It's like cracking a safe or using one of those miserable locks they have in men's gymnasia in universities, where you lock your stuff up, you know, so that can't be stolen. I could never, in 23 years, I could never remember the combination of my locker at Cornell, and I never used it. Incidentally, I never lost anything to my knowledge. But it's no good, there's no point in trying to do the stages out of the right order. You mustn't give it the signal for stage three when you're doing stage one. You must do it in the right order. So we call this the sequential effect. We don't put all the stimuli in the soup all at once, and we have to empirically discover these right signals. And then in the case of the asparagus, we make shoots without roots, roots without shoots, or the two together according to the way we manipulate it. So that tells you some of the possibilities. And here's a rather dramatic case of what we call this sequential effect. Here's a particular tobacco. In the presence of the basal medium plus coconut milk along here, there's very little growth, but what little growth there is trying to organize. If you add naphthalene acetic acid, there's a little growth down here, more than there, but there's no organization. But if you do the two together in the right proportions, you see here you get lots of growth and no organization. There you get little growth, but some organization. So what we do now with the tobacco was to give the little explant, the basal medium, nothing much happens, naphthalene acetic acid, more growth, coconut milk, some organization, but not as much growth, and the two together, a lot of unorganized growth. So we multiply cells with this kind of medium, then take the naphthalene acetic acid away and let the cells organize on the coconut milk. And then you see what happens. Beautiful green cells which have divided. And we inoculate those cells into liquid and grow our first tobacco baby to flower in a test tube quicker, in fact, than nature would normally have done it from seed in an ovule. But that hadn't come from sexual fertilization of a fertilized egg, fusion of gametes. It's come from a body cell that really remembers how to do everything if it gets the right signals at the right time and the right stimuli in the right medium. Just one or two other examples. The orchid industry has been taking little pieces of tissue for years now out of the tip of the shoot, and they grow a sort of a callus and a disorderly proliferation, and they let under aseptic condition buds and roots form. But here with a cymbidium plant, we went into just behind the growing point, like that mint plant I showed you about, and we grow cells, and we transfer the cells into tubes, and they form the normal development of an orchid in these little tiny green protocones.
and in the protocorm, a shoot and an aerial root develops, and here is a plant. And that has come not from an organized piece of tissue, but from free cells. And from the free cells, you see, they go protocorms and into plantlets like this. About 3 or 4 years afterwards, that cymbidium plant looked like that. And in 5.5 years, it flowered and produced a facsimile exactly of the inflorescence of the plant from which it came. And incidentally, one member of that population of cymbidium plants I still have in Charlottesville, Virginia, and it flowered beautifully last year. So that is the fact of what we can do with plants. Potentially, any flowering plant still has in its constituent cells the memory to do everything. If the cells are alive and they're what we call diploid, they have the original chromosome complement. But animal cells have been grown like in the free state for generations, as long as I can remember. The HeLa cells of cancer research came from a Mrs. Helena somebody or other, I've forgotten who. A long, long time ago. They've been grown by the ton almost over the surface of the earth. But nobody's ever detected any trace of a new Mrs. HeLa. And the difficulties are obviously very much greater. And the way I see it, there's a very good reason for this. Here is the gametes, and there's the egg. Down to here, it doesn't really matter whether you're studying insects, whether you're studying plants, corn, Drosophila, or frogs. The essential principles of the way the hereditary information is handed into the egg and then on into the constituent cells is essentially the same. But the developmental patterns are very, very different indeed. In plants, as we've seen, that little zygote forms a little embryo with a root tip and a shoot tip. And then it's a sort of open-ended kind of growth. A shoot can go on and it's potentially unlimited, unless it should terminate in a flower. But many plants will do this for centuries. Root tips have been cultivated by cutting off the tip of the root and growing them potentially unlimited. And the cells that are formed by these shoot and root tips have to retain, as it were, this memory easily accessible to make new shoots and new roots and new buds. But in the case of higher animals, as I see it, it's very different. Because the fertilized egg forms an embryo, and an animal embryo makes its organs once, as we've already remarked. And it assigns to those organs very, very special kinds of properties and structures and behavior patterns. And these are very firmly imprinted and very, very distinct. So much so that the animal doesn't rely on external stimuli to control its development. It's highly controlled in its own special internal environment. And it needs very powerful mechanisms to do this. A brain, a spinal cord, a strong hormonal system, a nervous system, all to make everything work in a coordinated fashion. And this isn't that open-ended kind of growth where everything can easily return to the zygotic or near-zygotic state, but it's a sort of a dichotomizing system like this, where the farther you go, the harder it is to go back. Of course, if you stop early enough up here, if that one cell divides into two and they split apart, you can get identical twins. And if for some strange reason the female uses these fertility drugs that people seem to favor nowadays, that may go on at least for a little while, and you get lots of embryos which more or less compete with each other. But by and large, the problem is not impossible in higher animals, but it presents very much greater difficulties. Now, what is the nearest approximation in animals to what we've been talking about? It's the work of Gurdon in Oxford that I was mentioned on the screen a little while ago. And what does he do? Well, he takes frogs. He goes to the development of a frog. And you know a frog forms a tadpole. And in the tadpole there are cells of the intestinal wall which he can take out. And he dissociates those cells that have learned in the tadpole to be intestinal wall cells. He dissociates them. But he can't take those cells and grow a frog directly. And when I last saw him, I always asked him the question, how near are you being able to do this? And he always tells me that he doesn't see it in sight. But what he does do is to get the nucleus out of those cells. The nuclei which had taken the information from the egg of the frog to make those wall cells in the intestine. And then he goes to a frog's egg. Now this is a very large egg, relatively speaking. And it's able to manipulate itself externally in the pond water. So he kills the nucleus in the frog's egg and takes it out. Enucleated frog's eggs. And then by ingenious technique, which I can only admire, he gets the nucleus that was in the intestinal wall into a frog's egg. So now you have an intestinal wall nucleus in the environment of a frog's egg. And in a satisfying number of cases, he goes ahead and develops into a frog. Now, if you do this with enough, you'll get a population of frogs all with the same genetic information in the egg. But it isn't quite like the cloning that we have in plants, because that nucleus can only express what in plants we call its the totipotency if it's back in the environment of the egg. But now to do this with higher animals is a very much more difficult thing again. Human eggs are not accustomed to develop outside the, in an easy medium outside the body. That perhaps will come. To take eggs out of body cells into other egg cells, that is to destroy the nucleus which was there and put it into another egg cell, is a matter of difficulty, even if you wanted to do it. But at least up to this point, so far as I know, to all intents and purposes, we can say that what is easily done with higher plants is not yet easily in sight with higher animals. But there's another point. If you could, should you do it? It's a strange thing, you know, that some people think that there's some satisfaction in being cloned. Personally, I couldn't care less. But certain middle-aged men seem to think that if they're cloned in this way, they'll sort of live it all over again. Well, obviously this is a lot of poppycock. Because let's suppose you clone the cells of an Einstein. What would you get? A mathematician? A brilliant musician? Or just an ordinary, able person? If you cloned a Winston Churchill, would you have a soldier of fortune, a statesman, a politician who was perhaps more politically able than always cautious, a soldier of fortune, a Nobel Prize winner in literature? Which of these things would happen? If you clone a Muhammad Ali, would you get an athlete or a writer of doggerel poetry? Obviously, the motivation for doing this is genetically more difficult, if not unsound, because the kind of qualities we're talking about are not the result of easy single genes or easy factors that can be you can put your finger on. They're the consequence of highly difficult and highly complicated interactions in which the environment plays a part too. And the essential part of the environment, which has to be remembered, is that the human egg, like the frog's egg, contributes that cytoplasmic environment which is necessary to transcribe the information in the nucleus. But now, believe it or not, and it's about time because of my voice, I've got to the point where I must wind up. And I like to wind up by showing you two more slides. And this one shows an experiment which I observed but didn't do during the war. It's been said that from 1940 to 1945, I was with the Ministry of Aircraft Production. And I didn't do, myself, a scientific experiment. But I had an office in London and an office in Harrogate, and I tried to spend my weekends in London so occasionally I could give some lectures in Birkbeck College. And I well remember the occasion when the Germans dropped on London what we called landmines. At Dunkirk, when they collared all the supplies, they captured some vicious things which the British were going to use for blowing up buildings and bridges. They were huge canisters with a thin wall and about a ton of tremendous blasting power explosives. And the Germans captured these things, and being an ingenious people, they said, how can we use them for the discomfiture of the British? So they did a nice, ingenious thing. They put them on parachutes, wheeled them over London, and let them down gently. And when they hit the surface of a building, instead of going like a bomb right down in the ground and digging a hole and wasting a lot of their blasting power, they went off with a tremendous wallop. And they just shook the whole building and just rendered it completely unusable. And they were most uncomfortable things, if you were in the Home Guard or elsewhere, to see them coming down in the sky. There was nothing you could do about it. But just behind Birkbeck College, where I used to be, and in the law courts, there were some 200-year-old plane trees, a number of them. And right here, about here, on the cement path, you see the steel railings had been taken down, and there were wooden ones, wire ones. One of these things went off with a tremendous bang, and it blew all the leaves and all the twigs off that big plane tree. And there I thought, that's that. That was in August. They just stuck up like great telegraph poles. But it wasn't that. Because next spring, it started to grow again, but in an entirely different way from is normal. If you prune a bush or a stem, the longest shoot comes out just below the cut, and the growth of that suppresses anything lower down. But you see, along the surface of this tree like this, it produced long shoots down here, tremendously crowded, and shorter shoots up there. And they were all on the surface nearest the blast, what I call the blasted surface of the tree. That isn't profanity, that's being accurate. And here you see the very long shoots at the base, the little ones up there. The whole system of polarity in that plant had been changed. But now if you went back to those trees after the years, you wouldn't know the difference. I now know the answer to that, because what actually happened was that the tremendous explosion took that tree, surface of that tree, and on the blasted surface it just shook it. And all the protoplasmic connections and the things that tie those cells together were broken. the cells were isolated. Not mechanically like they were in our flasks, but they were free from each other. And being in a nice warm medium with water and salts and nutrients in the spring, they went ahead and grew. And they remembered how to be plane trees. And there they were. But when the cambium and the other polarity and the organization of the plane was established later on, that was all suppressed and it became normal again. And here's my last slide. It's fact that out of carrot cells, free-floating cells, just like an egg in an embryo sac, which are dividing, two nuclei, out of free-floating carrot cells, we can grow carrot plants. Perfect in every detail, hundreds of thousands of them from one population. And out of cells like these, we make carrot plants with flowers like these, the Queen Anne's lace of our gardens, down accurately to the last detail, even that last useless bit of genetic information which turns the last few cells purple or pink. We can do it easily with carrot. We can't always do it with every economic plant that we would like to. If you could do this with Douglas fir or some of the palms or some of the conifers which are hard to breed, and you could go into the forest or the plantation and pick out the particular plant with a particular property and make a great many facsimiles of it, there are a great many useful applications. In some cases it can be done more easily in the cases which are of least economic importance. But one of these days, somebody will learn the trick. But as I've pointed out, the whole system of cloning animals and people is of an entirely different order of difficulty. And then the question arises, if you can do it, should you do it? And there are a great many reasons where I would say that I hope we'd have the wisdom not to do it. And that's my story, facts and fancies about cloning plants and people. I only regret that my voice has caused me perhaps more discomfort than you realize, and I've taken too long to tell it to you. Thank you very much.
Despite his voice, Dr. Stewart said he will take some questions from the audience. Yes, Mrs. Nemetz.
Dr. Stewart, when you were discussing the cloning of frogs, when they use the ovum of a female frog and they fertilize it with her own cell from her own intestine?
Well, to be quite candid, I don't remember. But it has been done by using different cells of the tadpole other than the intestinal wall, and I'm quite sure that they would and any frogs that could be crossed, this would take.
Yes.
Well, in plants, what we do, you see, is to start with a few cells and you make them divide so you get a very big population of cells. You fill the flask, if you want, with free cells. And then you bring them into the condition where they organize instead of just splitting apart. That's the trick. There's no parallel for that in the animal thing, because I don't think you could... You could do it this way.
From one free cell, what are the limiting factors of the number of reproductions you can make?
Well, one free cell will only, if you put that in the condition where it organizes, one cell goes to one embryo. But you could we don't do it from one cell, but you, if you put 100 cells in, you can make them divide as many times as you want and get thousands, and then bring them into the state where they'll make the embryos.
Yes, another question? Yeah. Sorry.
Do you visualize a fundamental difference between animal and plant cells that could account for the fact that you can't clone animals?
Well, in a long and checkered career, there's one thing I've learned, that plants are plants and animals are animals. And when you're dealing with higher plants on the one side and higher animals on the other, there are a great many differences in, particularly where development is concerned. Now, I'm not saying that the information in the nucleus of our own living cells may not eventually be recaptured. I'm not saying it won't be, but I'm saying that if it's there unimpaired, I think it's going to take a very, very much greater understanding than we have at present. Now, there would be one very easy way out. You see, in the animal, in the plant, the nucleus has the information, and the surrounding protoplasm, its cytoplasm, has the ability to transcribe it. The frog case shows that in the frog, the nucleus has the information. But if, as differentiation goes on, as the development goes on, if the fundamental changes are in the cytoplasm, you see, that would account for having to go back to the egg every time. And that possibly is the difference. And the reason why the plant has to, if you like, in evolution, has developed a way of growing which enables it to respond to this open-ended type of growth that I've told you about. And in order to do that, both the nucleus and the cytoplasm have to retain the original information in the egg, the totipotency. Does that answer the question?
Sounds good.
Sounds good, yes.
Dr. Cates?
Oh, yes, I forgot. Well, I told the people something about that last Thursday, was it? For my special benefit at Cornell, there was a hybrid horse chestnut tree grown out of the front of the physics building about 75 years ago. Now, the horse chestnut, like many nuts, forms a large fruit, and it grows rather rapidly, and it first fills up with a little liquid. And the embryo develops and absorbs that liquid during the season. Walnuts do this, and buckeyes do this. If the frost comes before the liquid's absorbed, it freezes the water and the thing is no good. But if the cotyledons, which is what you eat if you eat a walnut, if they've absorbed all the liquid, then it can ripen. So we went to seeking other sources for this. We went to those things. And we milked horse chestnuts. And it's volume for volume more powerful than coconut milk. But it isn't as easy to get hold of in big bulk for the biochemistry. It does similar things, but not identical things. Then there's another source, corn in the milk stage. If you get corn ovules, corn grains, when they're very young and they're in what is called the milk stage, you can extract an extract from corn, which also will do this. So we think it's wherever you can get hold of in sufficient bulk before it's used up, the special nutrition of a fertilized egg in an embryo sac, if you can get hold of it before it's used up, then this will do. And we've done biochemistry on quite a number of these.
Does the fact that
Well, the first thing is very important in some cases. Let's suppose you see you have a hybrid plant, some hybrids are sterile. They don't reproduce by seed. Therefore, in order to make it, get it, keep it going, you have to keep making the cross. So if you could propagate the hybrid in this way and preserve the cytology intact, then you fix it, as it were. That's one very important application.
Can you also look towards increased food crops from cloning as a means of producing more better yields?
Well, it's more a tool in breeding. I would never regard this technique as specifically a substitute for, say, conventional agriculture, because we have to grow these things in a complicated organic medium. It'd be like pulling yourselves up with your own bootstraps. They're using more sugar than they're making.
If there are no more questions, I'd like to ask Dr. Bruce Tregunna to thank our speaker.
Dr. Stewart, there's always a certain reluctance to thank a revolutionary leader because by tomorrow he may be challenging, in my case, my own biases or philosophies. But certainly for what you have presented this evening, I do indeed thank you. And as a scientist, I also thank you for telling those who are not scientists here that there is a need for a certain degree of serendipity, a lot of tedious work, and a great deal of time with steady support to achieve the kind of things which you have demonstrated. But on behalf of the audience, I thank you very much.